That song really says what I want to start talking about tonight, which is going to go on for a while. But I promise maybe next week or the following week, I'll put together a thing about the trip we just did. But I really want to get into evangelization, and that song says it all. We're going to talk about the need for evangelization. I think everyone will agree we're at a time now where we need a new evangelization. This isn't the first time in history. Hopefully it'll be the last time, because I hope he's coming back soon. But now is certainly a time for new evangelization. I mean, we're faced with just a darkness that's permeated the whole world. And I was really struck over the last few months that, you know, Ireland passed this unrestricted abortion bill, and they were dancing in the street about how they had stood up to the church, and finally now they were free. And the Prime Minister of Greece got up at the parliament and said, "Oh, we don't care what the churches say. This is what we're doing." And it's kind of like, you know, Satan's great sin of pride, where I don't want to do what God wants me to do. I want to do what I want to do. And that's the satanic rebellion in a nutshell. You know, I don't want to serve. I want to reign. We don't want to be told what to do. But, you know, we talked about the Great Commission, where Jesus told those guys they had to go preach the gospel everywhere, starting in Jerusalem. And by extension, that also applies to us. You know, and that song says, you know, God says, "Who am I going to send?" There's a great Hebrew word, hineni, that means here I am. What do you want me to do? You know, and that's in the Bible many times. I don't know if we did a hineni teaching here, but if we didn't, I'll put one together. But it's in, you know, Moses says it, and Abraham says it, Moses says it, Samuel says it. And then finally, and Isaiah says it. And then finally in the book of Isaiah, and I think it's chapter 59 maybe, or maybe it's 49, I don't know. It's somewhere in Isaiah, because he's my favorite major prophet. Isaiah writes, you know, when you live your life the way you're supposed to live your life, and when you help the poor, and when you do all these things, then when you pray, I, meaning God, will say, hineni, here I am. So he'll listen to you if you're living the life that he wants you to lead. So evangelization was important in the first century, because after all, those guys either went into a Jewish world that was dominated by the rabbis and the law, or they went into the Gentile world, which was dominated by the pagan religions of all these places. You know, and if you read in the book of Acts, I think it's chapter 26, I'm going to say something about that later. You know, Paul relates to, I think he's talking to King Agrippa at the time, that when Jesus revealed all these things to him, Jesus says you have to take the Gentiles away from the satanic religions that they have. Because these pagan religions were satanically based. Because it was a worship of many things, but not God. It was basically based on nature. And now we've seen that come back in our time. You know, we worship the earth, and we worship the air. You know, there's people who actually talk about, you know, the earth goddess, and there's people who don't talk about it in those terms, but that's what they mean. And wouldn't the earth be nice if there were no people? You know, you heard that. You know, there's too many people. If there weren't people, the earth would be just nice. Well, yeah, but God created the earth for humans to live on. He didn't create it just for the earth to be nice. But we're back in that same pagan time. And who would have ever thought that Europe, and now the United States and Canada following, would be a mission field again, like they were in the first 2-3 centuries? Who would ever thought of this? And like I always said, probably said it here before, the great churches of Europe used to send missionaries to Africa and to Asia and to the New World. Now they just have to send him to the corner and talk to people walking by because they don't have a clue what anybody's talking about. So it's the new evangelization again. And I also add this in honor of Pastor Dan, who one morning said, you know, the new evangelization is the same as the old evangelization. And I started chuckling, but as I thought about it, he's right. It's not a different evangelization. It's the same evangelization. And so like that song says, God calls to people to have them involved in this. And he calls to everyone to be involved in some way. You know, you have people say, well, you know, that kind of stuff's for the ministers and the priests and the, you know, the professional religious people. But no, it's for everyone. And for those of you that are Catholic, you know, the Second Vatican Council said every baptized Christian is to be an evangelist. Not some people are evangelists. You know, Billy Graham said, I'm an evangelist just like many thousands of others who were called. He happened to be a famous one. But there's thousands and thousands and thousands that nobody knows their name, but they're evangelizing. I think about that book. I can never remember the name of the pastor. Monica always has to tell me. I think you always tell me. He was praying and he went into like this ecstasy and he was in the throne room of heaven and Rick Joyner, that's right. And he went, long story short, he goes all the way to the front and he meets Paul. And he says to St. Paul, wow, you know, all my life I couldn't wait to meet you and now I don't even know what to say because you're so awesome. And Paul says to him, no, no, no. What you guys are doing now on earth is awesome. I wish I was there with you. And then he sees this other guy that he didn't know who he was and he says to Jesus in this vision, you know, who's this guy? And Jesus says, that's somebody or other. I can't remember his name. And he goes, I don't know who that is. And Jesus said, oh, if he was a homeless guy and all he had was a Bible and he spent his whole life going around telling other homeless people about me and preaching the gospel. And that's why he's sitting here next to Paul. And I said, whoa, that's pretty awesome. So we don't know who they all are. But there's always evangelization going on, and there's always people being prepared for this. And a lot of times, you know, you don't know that you are prepared, or you hear something about it, but you choose not to act on it because you think, well, I can't possibly do that. I can't possibly tell anybody. I don't want anybody to think I'm crazy. I won't say it right. I'm sure I'll screw it up. So somebody else will reach them. So when you think about it, as you go around, there's a lot of different audiences of people that hear you talk. Right? You know, in the scriptures, it's interesting to read through the New Testament where you always see like a group of people who say, they've had too much wine. You know, we can't even stand this for a minute and walk away. Then there's always a group of people that go, whoa, and they stay there. You know? So there's a lot of audiences. There's a lot of different people in these audiences, and you don't know who's going to be impacted. You know, you may be talking and somebody says, you know what, if you really believe that, you're crazy. And you may have people that say, wow, you know, I never thought about that before. And I'm sure you've all experienced it. Because there's different people who have all had different experiences. You know, now the experience is nothing. There's no religious experience for the most part in people who are less than, I don't know, certainly 30, maybe even more. They've not been raised with any kind of basic faith. They never went to any kind of basic church like when most of us were growing up. And it's a different world. And you can't go up to somebody who's 20 years old with a Bible in your hand and say, do you know what Paul says about... And they'll look at you like, Paul who? What are you talking about, dude? They didn't even know the fundamentals. They didn't even know that there's such a thing as sin, that there's such a thing as holiness, and that they're not holy, but they are in fact sinners. And that's the last thing on their mind. Because after all, you know, it's a very materialistic culture, and whoever dies with the most stuff wins, some people like to say. So everybody's had different experiences. You know, you may encounter somebody and you start telling them the gospel, and it strikes a chord with something they heard when they were a kid, when they went to Sunday school, or they were in catechism class somewhere. They hadn't been to a church since they were 16, but you may spark something that activates these memories. You may say something to somebody who says, I didn't realize that before. And I always like to use the example of when our daughter got married, she has this friend who's Jewish, and he's a nice young man, and I'm not sure how observant he is, but they've known each other since college, and they've always had a nice friendship, and she wanted him to do the Old Testament reading at the wedding ceremony. So we had the rehearsal on Friday night, and at this church there were Old Testament scenes painted around kind of like the sanctuary area. And one of them was a lamb on the tape on the altar and a guy with his hand on the lamb's head and the priest about to kill the lamb. And I brought him over and I said, do you know what that is? And he said, yeah, the priest's going to kill the lamb and sprinkle the blood at sacrifice. And I said, the lamb is Jesus. And he said, what? I said, the lamb is Jesus. And he said, nobody ever told me that before. So you don't know what people know or what they're thinking. And I don't know if any of you have ever witnessed to Jews, but you know, when you use the sacrificial system, that makes an impact compared to, hey, you know, you really need to believe in Jesus because, you know, he really was God, and it's like, whatever. But when you go through that and you say he was the lamb, it makes them think. Because when we say the word Christian, we think nice thoughts, right? Somebody says, oh, that was such a Christian thing to do, or, oh, that guy's a Christian, and you say, oh, it's nice. When they hear the word Christian, they think Hitler, Stalin, czars, persecutions. You know, they carry around all different meaning of the word. So you don't really know what their experience has been. And everybody's got different ideas within all these groups and different philosophies. And this is not something new. You know, in Ecclesiastes it says there's nothing new under the sun. It's always been like this. Adam and Eve's kids probably argued about different philosophies. There's nothing new. But people say, well, you know, the God I believe in would never do that. Or the God I believe in loves everyone. Well, yeah. Well, the God I believe in just does what makes me happy, or, you know, whatever. And this is how people live their lives. And so they have different philosophies, different ideas. So, before we get into what's evangelism, say, who is an evangelist? I mean, in order to be an evangelist, number one is you have to know what the message is, right? You have to know the message of the gospel. Every religion wants you to be nice to everybody, right? Every religion says, well, I don't want to make blanket statements, but every religion knows it's wrong to steal, right? Every religion knows you shouldn't commit adultery. Every religion knows you shouldn't kill other people without any kind of cause. I mean, that's sort of generally understood human experience, right? Everybody knows you should help people who can't help themselves, or you should try to do something. I mean, every religion on earth has those things in common, right? And now in our time, this is what Christianity has become. Just another philosophy of being nice to everybody and helping the poor, making sure everybody has this, and, you know, And that's good. Social justice is very important. And in 2,000 years of Christian thinking, there's always been moral teaching about helping poor people, helping sick people. You know, despite what the liberal media and liberal philosophies everywhere tell you, it's been the Christian churches that have changed Western society. Hospitals, schools, universities, prisons, you know, reform of every kind of labor. And I mean, we all know that. So the question is, who can be an evangelist? How are they going to be prepared to be an evangelist? How are you going to know what the message is? Because, you know, Jesus is not one man in a long line of peers. He doesn't have peers. He's not on the same ground as Buddha and Muhammad and Krishna and whoever else you can name, Confucius. He's not an equal, right? If we preach just social gospel, well, then every religion's good. Every religion's equal. And every religion's going to the same place. Right? An atheist can be helpful to people, right? And can be nice. I mean, if you were a billionaire and you were an atheist and you gave $20 million to this charity and $20 million to that charity and $50 million to that charity, everybody'd say, wow, that's awesome. And it is awesome, but that's not the message. That's things that happen because of the message. You know, Paul says we're saved unto good works. We're not saved by the good works. We're saved unto good works. So when you come to know Jesus and understand who he is, you will immediately start to do things that are considered good works because he wants you to do them. Social justice is important. So the question is, how do you get the message straight? So we're going to start with Saul of Tarsus, because he's my favorite guy. He's like my hero. Even though he probably didn't write Hebrews, which is my favorite book. I like all the other stuff. And we just got back from going to St. Paul places, and it's pretty amazing. But we're going to start with him because he's the logical place to start. I mean, compared to those bunch of dopes that walked around with Jesus, he stands head and shoulders and heel. He stands 10 times the height of any of those other guys in terms of intellect, power, and he was amazing. Those other guys, you know, they were awesome. They were pretty dopey in comparison, but we'll get to them later. They were also prepared to be evangelists, but I want to talk about Paul because, first of all, when he was Saul of Tarsus, we all know the story about his conversion, but in Philippians 3, he points out that if anybody had anything to boast about, it would be him. Because, you know, he doesn't say in so many words, but he says, I studied under the best rabbi. I know 3 or 4 languages fluently in complicated grammar. I've studied the law since I was a kid. I know everything there is to know about Judaism. I know everything there is to know about philosophies and civilizations, and I'm pretty smart. After all, you can't be a Pharisee if you're not sort of the cream of the crop Jewish guy. You know, the Pharisees didn't take in people who were like, you know, Peter and some of those other guys. I mean, they would have looked at him and said, you out. And I'm sure they wouldn't have let Jesus in their midst either. They would have said, you out, which they did say. So, looking back on this in Philippians 3, he says, I could boast because I was circumcised on the 8th day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. a Hebrew of Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning righteousness, which is the law, blameless. So I was blameless under the law. I was righteous because of the law. I was so zealous that I persecuted the believers. That's how zealous I was. And there's been people like this through history, right? We all know about things like the Inquisition, the religious wars that took place all through history, but after the Reformation, there were religious wars all over Europe where people killed each other, burned each other at the stake because they had some different belief about something. So Paul was not the only one, but he's pointing out that this is who he was. And one thing somebody like this doesn't do, he doesn't talk to Gentiles. He doesn't hang out with Gentiles. He doesn't go to a Gentile house. He doesn't go to a building where Gentiles are. You know, the chief priest is yelling to Pontius Pilate across the pavement because if he set foot in the praetorium, he'd be defiled. So that's why he's talking. They wouldn't enter or they'd be defiled for the Passover. So it was okay for them to plot to kill somebody, but they didn't want to step in the Gentile place. This was Paul. He might have been there that day. We don't know. He never mentions it. Tradition says that Paul was about 8 years younger than Jesus. That's just a tradition. There's no proof of that. Paul never mentions when he's born, except his later epistles, like in Timothy. One of the later epistles, he calls himself an old man. And in Acts 7, when Stephen is stoned, it says a young man named Saul held their cloaks so that they could throw rocks better. So he was a young guy when Stephen was stoned, and then he died in the year 67. It said he called himself an old man, which in those days, you know, would have been somebody in their 50s, probably 60s for sure, you'd be an old man. So, this is in Galatians 1. For you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my fathers. I was more zealous than all of them. I was advancing more than anybody. This is a proud guy. Right? This is an intelligent guy, a proud guy. I was the best at everything I did. And because he was 8 years younger than Jesus, let's say he was, we don't know, but let's say he was, and from the time of his bar mitzvah till the time he was converted, he was in the temple studying under Gamaliel. So he made his bar mitzvah and he was 13. Jesus would have been 21. Let's say Saul wasn't converted till probably at least a year, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years after Jesus was gone. So they would have been in the temple at the same time for the feast days, that last week of Jesus' earthly life when he spent every day teaching in the temple. Wouldn't stay there at night, but he was there during the day. So I like to think they might have passed each other in the courtyard. And Saul would never have even noticed Jesus in this group because they would have been lower class. I'm the guy who's advancing. I don't know who these guys are. But I like to think that Jesus looked at him and said, little do you know what's going to happen. So why is he called Saul of Tarsus? He was not born in the land. He was not born in Israel. He was born in Tarsus, which is in present-day southern Turkey. Kind of on the lower rim, if you can picture Turkey jutting out. And it was a Roman city But all that area was Greek. And everybody in this area had Greek ancestry. And, of course, spoke Greek. And Greek was the language of the educated people. So all through the empire, educated people spoke Greek, not Latin. This is why when Jerome writes the first Latin Bible, it's called the Vulgate. Because Latin was, you know, kind of the vulgar language. It was the common language. Greek was the educated language. So he grows up in this town, in this city called Tarsus, which was Hellenized. It was Greek. And it was a flourishing seaport. Jews hate the sea. Jews hate the ocean. Jews never go anywhere in the ocean. You never read in the Bible Israelis sailing anywhere. But you do read about Paul sailing. Paul grew up, this was a port town. And there was a river that came through it that was very navigable. So there were ships going up and down the river and out into the Mediterranean. So he grew up surrounded by nautical stuff. And his family was prosperous. So they had all kinds of stuff. They educated him from the time he was really small. Long before he went to Jerusalem. And I forgot what his father did for a living, but they had a very prosperous family. So he had a good education. You know, the guys who were the apostles, when you think about it, at least three or four of them were fishermen. Maybe they were educated, maybe they weren't. Matthew was a tax collector, so he probably had some education. Because you know why tax collectors were so looked down on, right, in that time? Because they worked for the Romans, number one. So they worked for the oppressor. And number two is, if the Romans said, you know, we need 10 shekels from this guy, and anything above that you collect, you can have. So they said, okay, you owe 13 shekels, and they'd keep three and give the Romans 10. And so they'd get paid by the Romans, plus they would intimidate people into paying them more money. This is why there's so much stuff about tax collectors in the New Testament. It wasn't like people who worked for the IRS. But we won't go into that. So he had this amazing education, and because of where he lived, he spoke fluent Greek. And when you read the epistles, how many people read the epistles and say, wow, this sentence is like five verses long? The sentences are very complicated. And sometimes you have to reread it. Now, they had no punctuation in these days. And sometimes you have to reread it and see where the commas are because there's so much stuff all in one sentence. Look through some of the letters sometimes. He wrote in the most complicated Greek grammar that there was. So the Greek language, all this was to prepare for the gospel to spread. You had the Greek language, which was the educated people. I'm sure that he spoke Latin because it was a Roman city. He certainly spoke Hebrew because he was trained. There was a big synagogue in Tarsus. His father was kind of a big shot at the synagogue. So he certainly spoke fluent Hebrew. Whether he knew Aramaic and some of the other stuff, I don't know, but you have to assume he knew at least three languages fluently. And all this was ready for the gospel to spread. Plus, the Roman Empire was at complete peace because nobody could make war against Rome. So it was the Pax Romana, so everything was quiet. The Romans had roads, they had shipping lanes. So everything was ready for not only Paul, but for all those guys to travel around. And they didn't have to worry about getting in the middle of a war. So everything was ready for the gospel. And there's three places where Paul's conversion is mentioned. Acts 9 is the one that's most commonly used. The other two are testimonies that he gives to others about what happened to him on the road to Damascus. So, do we all know what happened on the road to Damascus? Okay. Blinding light. He falls down. We We don't know if he fell off a horse or he just fell down. Doesn't mention a horse. But I'm sure he wouldn't be walking to Damascus because he was a pretty important guy. He might have even had a chauffeured chariot or something. I don't know. But he's blinded. He hears Jesus talk to him. And in the Acts 9 account, we hear, you know, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And he says, who are you, Lord? He says, I'm Jesus who you're persecuting. Who? I wasn't expecting this. I thought those guys back in Jerusalem made this all up. I thought they were just a bunch of idolaters. That's why I'm here to kill them. By this time, he had killed people. He had ordered people killed. He had ordered people imprisoned. Not exactly who you think an evangelist is going to be. And then he goes, you know, 3 days in Damascus. They have to lead him there because he can't see. So for 3 days, he's in this room. He doesn't eat. He doesn't drink any water. And then a man named Ananias gets a word from the Lord to go to the street, even tells him what street Paul's staying on, a street called Straight, Straight Street, not to be confused with State Street. But and he says, you're going to go pray over him. And Ananias says, well, Lord, I don't know if you really have heard about this guy, but he's killing believers and he's putting people in prison. And I'm thinking maybe it's not a good idea to go over there. But, of course, he obeys and he goes. Now I just think it's so cool because he walks in the room and calls him Brother Saul. Then he talks to him. He prays over him. The scales fall off his eyes and he baptizes him. Whew. This guy who was like nobody, you never hear about him again, I don't think, gets to heal Paul from his blindness and baptizes him. So for the rest of his life, he could say, I baptized Paul. And these other accounts, we are going to talk about in a sec, but he just, these are testimonies that he gives about what happened on the road. And there's accounts of Jesus telling him more stuff. But the bottom line is he gets an incredible amount of revelation all downloaded into his brain. So that guy who was so zealous for the law and doing all that stuff and advancing and killing and putting people in prison is now pretty much getting a different idea about what exactly the truth was, is. So he gets a direct message in the 26, Acts 26, 16. But rise and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to make you a minister and a witness, both of the things which you have seen and of the things which I will yet reveal to you. I will deliver you from the Jewish people as well as from the Gentiles to whom I now send you to open their eyes, in order to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who are sanctified by faith in me. What's the gospel? Well, let's see. I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to protect you from these people that are going to persecute you. I'm going to send you to the Gentiles. Wait a minute, this is the guy who's the Pharisee, tribe of Benjamin, Hebrew of Hebrews, Pharisee of Pharisees, zealous for the law, advancing, zealous to put people in prison. He was going to Damascus with an order from the chief priest to bring back Jews who were believers in Jesus so that they could be tried. That's why he was going to Damascus. He wasn't going on vacation. He wasn't going there because he liked it. He was on a business trip, but he had papers to arrest these guys that were there. Now, I'm going to send you to the Gentiles to open their eyes. Now, he's blind when he's hearing this. He can't see anything. You're going to open their eyes in order to turn them from darkness to light. Wait a minute. What do Gentiles have to do with the gospel? What do Gentiles have to do with anything that's in our law, our scripture, our traditions, our books? We don't think there's anything in there about Gentiles. Well, actually, there is. Isaiah talks a lot about it, as we saw. But what do Gentiles have to do with this? Why does Simeon, the prophet Simeon, when he picks little baby 40-day-old Jesus up, says this, he's going to be a light to the Gentiles? That's a pretty crazy thing to say to a little Jewish boy who's just been born and his horrified mother and foster father, Gentiles. We don't want Gentiles coming anywhere near this kid. How are we going to be a light to the Gentiles? I'm going to send you to them, Mr. Pharisee, Mr. Nice Robes, Mr. Holy Guy, Mr. Zeal. I'm going to send you to the Gentiles so you can turn them from the power of Satan to God. And why? So they can have their sins forgiven and have an inheritance among those who are sanctified by what? Faith in me. Not sanctified because they're going to be nice to the beggar. Not sanctified because they're going to give money to the local Zeus charity or, you know, some other pagan god. You know, you're going to contribute money to build a new temple for Venus or something. They're going to do any of that. They're going to be sanctified by faith in me. So he's telling this to a Pharisee who all of a sudden, from being that proud guy, is laying on the ground, surrounded by this light. He can't see anything. So he's going to be a light, and he's going to open their eyes. And guess what? Because of you, Mr. Pharisee, the Gentiles are going to be forgiven of their sins. And the Gentiles are going to come to their inheritance because they're going to believe in me. Remember the parable of the two parables of the vineyard that we talked about, I don't know how long ago. You know, the vineyard is going to be taken away from the people who don't know how to take care of it and given to people who are going to produce fruit. That's why we're here. All these unclean Gentiles are going to end up producing fruit. And it's going to be partly, mostly, because of you. So he experiences the Lord. We've all experienced the Lord that are here. I don't know if any of us, you know, saw a bright light and went blind. Well, you've had kind of a experience. But, you know, we saw things, heard things, felt things, realized things that changed your life. Right? Everybody's had a life-changing experience. And all of a sudden, you're filled with this knowledge of salvation. Wow. You know, these people are, you know, like the Philippian jailer says, what must I do to be saved? Even the people said, to Jesus, well, who can be saved? How can I be saved? How can I get eternal life? I mean, this is the question of the ages, right? Everybody wants eternal life. It's a question of the ages. It's not a matter of how many points you get or how well you do something. So you're filled with the knowledge of salvation. All of a sudden, Saul of Tarsus, who spent his whole life up to this moment studying what he knew to be the truth, and it was the truth, these are laws from God. You know, Christians look at the law and say, oh, you know, the law. Well, Paul says, is the law evil? Of course not, because the law comes from God. The law shows you that you're a sinner. The law is not evil. It's not some dirty trick. It's not something somebody made up. So he's filled with the knowledge of salvation. And he's given a mission. I'm going to send you to be a light. I'm going to send you to tell people. I'm going to send you to people you had no idea that you even were going to have any kind of contact with whatsoever. But you've been prepared. You speak all the languages they speak. You're intelligent, cultural. You can fit into societies where you go. You know, later on, Paul's going to say, I have become all things to all people in order to save some. To the Jew, I'm a Jew. To the Greek, I'm a Greek. Whatever I have to do to save people. Right? And isn't that such an important part of evangelization? Because if you start talking to somebody and they tell you something and you go, whoo, man, if you're doing that kind of stuff, I'm not talking to you anymore. You know, you kind of walk out the door. Because that's who is the person who needs salvation. And maybe you're there just to reach that person. You know? That's possible. So he had been prepared in all these different ways that he didn't even really know he was being prepared. And same things are happening to us. We don't know all the things that have happened to us that have prepared us for what we're supposed to do. You know, those other guys that he associated with in Jerusalem, the high priest and all those other bozos, they would not have felt comfortable going into Gentile cities and preaching anything. Paul was used to Gentiles around because he lived in the as a Roman citizen in Tarsus. There were Jews there, but there were a lot of mostly Gentiles there. He was used to all kinds of different people. So he was ready, and he had been prepared, and he's faithful to the mission. Well, you know, when this happens to him in Acts 9 and after Ananias heals him, he doesn't say, well, you know, I got to think about this a while. Maybe I had too much new wine. Maybe it was all a dream I had. I know I've been working too hard persecuting Christians, and maybe it finally got to me. I'm a little stressed out. No, he gets immediately into it. And when he finally goes back to Jerusalem some years later, none of the brothers want to have anything to do with him because they know who he is. And then somebody says, you know, Barnabas says, oh, no, no. He's been talking about Jesus everywhere. He's been preaching. He goes into the synagogue in Damascus and starts saying that Jesus is the Christ. And he reasons with him and he debates with him. Few days later. So that's responding to the call, being faithful to the call. Therefore, having obtained help from God, to this day I stand, witnessing both to small and great, saying no other things than those which the prophets and Moses said would come, that the Christ would suffer, that he would be the first to rise from the dead and would proclaim light to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. What am I saying? Am I saying some crazy new thing like, what is it? What's the name of the people that said the aliens started their religion? The what? Scientology, yeah. Was he preaching some philosophy that came down from some alien or that he got from some South American Indian tribe? No, he says, I don't say anything else other than what the prophets and Moses said. Because all you need is Moses and the prophets to understand Jesus. All you need is Moses and the prophets to understand salvation. All you need is Moses and the prophets to understand that the Christ would suffer, that he would rise and he'd proclaim light even to Gentiles. Because he knew what was written in Isaiah about Gentiles. He knew that he could probably recite the Torah by memory. He knew all this. This was all he did. And he was no fun at parties when he was a Pharisee. Because all he did was recite the lines. You know, if you said, hey, Paul, you want to go out for a drink? He'd say, let me tell you what it says in Leviticus 19. He was no fun to hang out with. He was intense. But he says, I don't preach anything different, and I don't care who it's to. Small and great, men or women, Jews or Greeks. there'd have been Swedes there to preach to Swedes, whoever it would have been. I don't say anything different other than what we know from our scripture. For the Jews request a sign, the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. What do we preach? Christ crucified. What's the gospel? Christ crucified. Because of that, everything else comes. From that, everything comes. If he's not crucified, then we're still in the same position that all those guys in the era of the Torah and the prophets were. We still don't have a way to deal with our sin. We still don't have a way to have fellowship with God, other than some minor little atonements here and there with some animal. We preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block. It's a stumbling block to people. You know, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. I've laid a stone in Zion, and people are going to stumble over it. Jesus is a stone. You either trip over the stone, or you understand what the stone is. Right? And to the Greeks, foolishness. When Paul's on the Areopagus talking to the philosophers, what do they say? What is this babbler trying to say? See, this guy's out of his mind. Let's call him a babbler. What is this babbler trying to say? Then when he talks about the resurrection, they say, oh, now we know you're a goofball. Somebody died and then they weren't dead anymore? We'll get back to you on that. They said, we'll talk with you about this later. But right now, we think you're a babbler. They thought he was mentally ill. But to those who are called, Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 1. This is the wisdom of God, the power of God. It's the cross. This is the evangelization. You don't hear much about that anymore, even in churches. Oh, yeah, you know, 15 years ago I signed the card, somebody said the prayer. Oh, that's nice. What have you done lately? Nothing. You don't have to do anything. You have to know what the message is. And I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom declaring to you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and much trembling. Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes it's scary. He was in Corinth for 18 months, and sometimes he got scared. And he heard Jesus say, don't worry, I have people in the city. Just keep talking. He got into that mindset like Elijah. I'm the only one. And he heard Jesus say, I have people in the city. Don't be afraid. I don't know anything except Christ and him crucified. Even though I'm scared and I'm afraid of what's going to happen. And then sometimes I'm even trembling. I'm so scared. It's not my excellent speech. It's not like when I was a Pharisee and I said, well, you know what it says in Numbers 10:9. He was scared most of the time. But all he knew about was Christ and Christ crucified. And my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in the demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Why could I do this? Because there was power demonstrated by this. The power of the Spirit is demonstrated by this. And I know that when I watched what happened to people, they weren't being changed by me. And the power wasn't released because I said such awesome words. The power was released because of the Spirit. So that's why these guys here who heard me talking to those guys in the synagogue said, those guys don't listen to you. We want to know what you have to say. And we don't know anything about Judaism, but now we believe that Jesus is the Christ. You encounter people on the street say, we've never been to a church in our life, but now I understand what you're telling me. I haven't been to a church since I was in high school, but now I understand. Because it's the power of the Spirit, not the power of what you say. I mean, the power of what you say is that it is power in what you say, but it's through the Spirit, not words, human wisdom. You know, you can debate. There's so many books. You could probably find thousands of books written about Jesus with all kinds of facts and information. You can read those all. None of that's going to save you. You just read about his life and say, what an interesting guy. You know, just this past Easter, I heard all this nonsense about Jesus died in solidarity for the poorer and working class people. Well, how do you die in solidarity? You know, it's like this Marxist Jesus who's rising up for the underprivileged. And he is for the underprivileged, but this is the key. So Paul, was he an evangelist? Was he prepared? How was he prepared? Well, we went over all that. Yeah, he was prepared. Did he know what the message was? Yeah. He's the linchpin of the change of the old covenant to the new covenant. He's the law, the Pharisee. He's the evangelist. He's the apostle of grace. He's the apostle to the Gentiles. And he didn't expect any of that, did he? That day he left for Damascus, he thought he was going to be there a few days, then he was going to be back. He probably had an apartment in the temple. He was there all the time. So this is just the beginning of some things I want to talk about over the next few weeks about evangelization. We're not all going to be like this or anywhere close to this. But, you know, like Mother Teresa used to say, you can't do great things, but you can do small things with love. You know, you may evangelize two or three people in your whole life, and that may be what your mission is. You may not be like Billy Graham. But the thing is to notice how you're prepared, what the call is, and knowing what the message is.